So if you can start off with giving us some idea about like difference in like public markets, early stage, micro caps, private markets, up to you.
Sure. So I think the key difference obviously is that early stage companies are fairly new, wherein so there are the promoters or the co-founders, as we call it, they've just thought about the business and they've created this company only with the idea or perception of either gradually growing it and in the interim also raising money in the private way, wherein they will only raise it from a handful of investors. And a public company has already been in existence in private form for maybe years, and then just for a inflection point or a point in time wherein they decide that, okay, they need that additional capital from the general public and not a handful of investors, that's when they decide to go public and raise that money. So in layman's term, that is when an IPO happens, right? Like, that is the primary reason why IPOs used to happen in the past, to raise money for growth. Obviously, nowadays, when we talk about IPOs, there are various reasons where the company has already grown and it's listed to unlock value for a lot of shareholders already there in the company who have given them money in the past. So that's the primary distinction. But exchanges in a formal form, they've been in existence for almost, say, 30 years. That's the Bombay Stock Exchange. But even prior to that, companies used to trade in an illiquid form, either through OTC, over the counter, or whatever you call it. Yeah. So exchanges have been in existence for long. And that's the reason that almost more than 4,500 companies are listed on the Bombay Stock Exchange as of today. And there have been a lot of defunct companies, if you include those defunct companies who got listed but now are completely wiped off for various reasons. There would be additional, say, 2,000-3,000. So these are the companies who've been there. And with the addition of the SME exchange, there would be, so we can say that totally maybe 10,000 companies would have tried to list, and some of them survived, some of them didn't survive. So that's the genesis of the public markets. But early stage companies have been in existence for years, but the entire way how they raise money is it's fairly different from what a public market company would have done in the past. And when you think about listed companies, you would also think about that there are multiple generations been running a business, and they are more self-sustainable, and they've grown their business, say, maybe 30, 40 years, and they've been existent. Some of them would be in existence from more than 50 years, but they only decide to raise money 30, 40 years after existence. And on the contrary, early stage companies, the whole concept of early stage, especially in India, would be, say, 15 years old, 16 years old. And maybe in US it was there from 1970s, 1960s. But the idea of an early stage company or a startup is that they want to grow fast, they want to prove their business model quickly. And the moment when someone says that I want to grow my business quickly, or I have a big disruption coming up which I can take over all the traditional businesses in a quick span, that's where I only want to raise money from a handful of private folks. I do not want to go to the larger public. And there is also a reason that going public needs you to be at a specific scale already. Yeah.
So if I have an idea and I'm very enthu about this idea, and so I just can't go to the public markets.
Yeah,
and
because
say,
you don't have
me.
That scale. Yeah. Regulatory wise, you don't have that scale. Now, the point is that listing is always a starting point, right? Microcaps are created because after listing, they don't end up doing anything. It's like investing in a startup, and after 5 years, you realize that there is nothing happened over there. So obviously, the valuation will shrink automatically.
You mean growth is not possible for is there a temporary bottleneck for growth for microcaps, or
no? So they've become microcaps. They never intended to be microcaps. Okay?
Oh, okay,
but startups, by definition, they are like infants, right? They just started. But microcaps are companies, maybe just to put it in some context, maybe the regulatory definition might be very different. But just for our conversation, maybe we can take it as any company which has a market cap or a valuation of less than 500 crore.
Okay.
We can call it a microcap.
I think before we go on to, we proceed to microcaps. So on early stage, it's not like everyone can invest in early stage, no? Like, I mean, like, let's say my mother wanted to invest in early stage, it's not like she can.
Yeah, so that's more about reach, right? But nothing stops her law-wise or regulatory-wise.
Okay.
Or if she's, someone explains her, if she's not able to understand and if she has money.
Bottleneck is money then?
Yeah, bottleneck. So, bottleneck is money, and also the other bottleneck is whom does the promoter think as of a good investor to have on his side?
But in early stage, where does the promoter come in? Like, I mean,
promoter means the co-founder.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So it's the traditional word is promoter.
Okay.
The early stage word is say co-founder. So a co-founder decides first that if he has a choice in the first place, that whom does he raise money from, and what does that person add value in terms of beyond money. So these are the two considerations. But if the co-founder is fine with raising from anyone, then there is no bottleneck, because basically it's a private limited company that the promoter is the founder has started, and his whole idea is that I will be creating a business which will create value for all my investors,
hopefully
including himself or herself.
Yeah.
Right. So that's the genesis of an early stage company. And why would someone be interested in an early stage company versus a public market company is because it's like, so I keep giving that example, a blank slate is always more valuable than a slate which has something written on it which you don't like, right? Although inherently both are just slates, you can rub off what is written on a written slate, but there is an effort involved, right? So you would rather buy the blank slate with a host. If someone giving you the vision that magically some words will appear on it after 7 days, so you buy that vision. Sometimes the words appear, sometimes the words do not appear.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why the blank slate is always, so I think the public and private market investment choice is more psychological, right? Because inherently a young company creating value quickly is what you're looking for, versus large companies or public companies who've been in existence for years, and you have to think about what have they already done. You have to analyze their past, you have to figure out, so there is a legacy involved over there already. So there is already something which has already happened, and you have to evaluate that before choosing them to invest.
So at this point I feel I kind of agree with you, but here is where how I'm approaching this. Like,
sure.
I think the risk appetite is like major in this. No, I mean, in the sense that, so if I take the public market example, let's say I know that Apple has been growing every year for X percent.
Yeah.
And I look at the world around me, and I see Apple products just taking over culturally, maybe. And even when I look at my friend circles, most of them seem to be buying, let's say, an Apple product. So I see some kind of predictability there, and maybe X percent growth, I'm okay with that kind of growth, even though it may not be like 100x or 200x.
Sure.
But on early stage, when I maybe think about it, it's like the startup claims to be like the next Google,
next
or Apple.
Thing, yes.
But what if something
we
don't know, and what if I put my 100k there, and next thing I know, in the next year it's all bankrupt. So the risk appetite seems to be very crucial.
So because ultimately, because anything which has to be achieved in a shorter span of time, it's like driving a car slow or fast, right? If you're going in a 30 km/h auto, it's always safer versus a same auto going at 100 km/h. The benefit is that you reach the place faster, and sometimes you don't know whether is there a requirement to reach fast or not. You don't know, but the adrenaline that you get by sitting in that 100 km/h, some people are not happy with that adrenaline, some people are happy with that adrenaline. And point is, if it reaches on the same place at 3x faster speed, then you are ready to. So for example, just take this very common example from here to say a Bangalore airport, right? One auto at 30 km/h will make you reach there at say 2 hours. The other one is promising you that I'll make you reach there in 35 minutes. Now let's take that hypothesis out for the moment, that whether you need to reach there in 35 minutes or not. So you'll choose that 35-minute one because you want to reach there, you want to feel that adrenaline, and if it reaches, you created value for yourself by making, maybe in this case, catching the flight, otherwise we would have missed it.
Mm-hmm.
So the same way with money, someone is happy with the routine kind of investments or business models wherein they've been in existence for years, or they've been in, the asset class has been in existence since years, and they're okay, they are risk averse, or they are okay with the speed. But the early stage company will promise you that speed, promise you that this innovation or this business will be created in a shorter span of time, technically speaking, and I will disrupt something which is already not there. So, for example, when you speak about, say, OpenAI or Google or anything, right, they would have been very small at some point in time wherein they would have given that vision to someone. And most, lot of them would have been risk averse, would have been out of that story already. But they promise that they'll do something disruptive and they'll do it too soon. So that is the reason why early stage companies, although being companies, their valuation perception or their promise perception is so different from the legacy businesses.
So I want to push on here's my thought. Let me know what you think about this. In the sense that if I look at Google, obviously I agree with you in the sense when you say legacy, I look at like the search component of their business, which is like the highest.
Yeah.
It earns like, I think majority of their profits come from that business. But I'm also thinking, where I'm trying to connect this is like the adrenaline or the uncertainty of like early stage.
Yeah,
there's obviously that uncertainty factor. But I feel like that is also kind of there in large corporations as well. Correct me if I'm wrong. In the sense that when I think about like Google or Microsoft or even Apple maybe, there is always like, you know, they have to keep, if I look at a cloud business per se, like, you know, they are still, there is a lot of uncertainty there. Or if I look at OpenAI recently has been kind of, you know, maybe encroaching on the search business as well. So I feel like even though I agree that their core fundamentals, they might have one aspect where, you know, maybe the money keeps systematically pouring in, but that part is not really sure and you always are on the lookout for like...
No, so see, there's a difference between uncertainty of time and uncertainty of business model, right?
Understood.
Yeah, you don't know what is lying up for us for tomorrow, right? But that does not mean that at least you are sure where you're going to wake up for now. But point with some sort of companies is you don't know what the business model will actually transpire into. It's just written words, right? So people are okay with uncertain days or uncertain phases in a particular business, in large business, wherein, okay, they don't know what will happen in cloud. Will something else disrupt cloud, or will there be a big competitor like Oracle just taking over the business already?
Mm-hmm.
So those are all debatable uncertain risks. But with a young company, the biggest problem, biggest risk, not a problem, but biggest risk is that you don't know what the company has thought about. Is it actually going to turn into that? So that's what an early stage company technically is. Obviously, nowadays, a lot of second generation, same family members, they're calling they create some side business and they start calling it startups, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they start raising money for that. So in the true sense, what is an early stage startup is that it's unique because it's trying to get to some place in a quicker time frame. And to do that, they need capital, and they need capital maybe at faster intervals, regular intervals, so that they can keep experimenting to reach where they aim to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll again, the point is that when there is nothing known, you're readily willing to give a high valuation to that. So although we'll discuss the valuation bit a bit later, it's like seeing someone for the first time and you feeling, okay, you're getting a good vibe. Okay, this guy or girl is great. But only when you get to know them better, or you have your own judgments, you have your own maybe perceptions of being created, and you keep molding those perceptions as you know the person better, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the day when you did not know her, you were only wanting to be pleasantly surprised, right? You never wanted to have a negative experience the first day. So that's with young companies, that because there is nothing on the table in terms of tangible creation, so obviously there are different stages of an early stage company. There will be something tangible, but there the delta of that intangible is so huge that you would want to bet on that. So obviously the failure risk also goes high because you're going at 100, 120 km/h in a very skimpy vehicle. The chances of you falling and not reaching your destination is very high. But you're choosing to take that risk. The investors, there is the venture capitalists or the type of investors where they are putting their money into, they are knowingly doing it because they want to create money out of disruption. And so point is that when we talk about microcaps, on the contrary, we are trying to create money through valuation mismatch. Basically, I tell you that there are 3 cups of coffee, and like you know that there are 3 guests sitting outside who would want to order them. But I offer you, because I don't have time, I'll tell you that, okay, this is available at 5 rupees a cup. What do you do about it? It's not disruptive, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just a cup of coffee. But you see an opportunity that, okay, someone outside is wanting to have a cup of coffee at 20 rupees, might as well take it at 5 rupees and immediately sell it to them.
It's like arbitrage, isn't it?
Yeah. It's more not arbitrage. It's more of an opportunity that something cheap is available. Now, that's the second case that they take so the risk that you're taking is they might not like the coffee.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not thinking on disruption over here. You're thinking on maximizing your value through buying something cheap.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the same goes with businesses, right? Public markets, because there is so much of data available, because of this data availability, point is that people try to put numbers to justify their actions, right? So that's the reason why in public markets, you'll see a lot of valuation tools being used.
Right.
Yeah? Versus...
Right. But before we go to public markets,
yeah,
and microcaps,
yeah.
One thing that you mentioned, and I'll take 2 digressions from here, I think.
Sure.
So one is how you mentioned these established businesses,
mm-hmm,
or family businesses, when they start,
mm-hmm,
when they start like a side business, and then they call that a startup.
Yeah.
So just to maybe touch on, like, so at least my definition of a startup is like, at least the way I think about it is, it should always be like a tech, like there should be like a major tech component to it,
mm-hmm,
plus the ability to grow exponentially, or at least to reach like a very large market. Like, only that can be called a startup. Is
no,
that
so,
fair or
no, I don't think that is fair. So we at Roots Ventures also, so we invest in consumer tech, consumer brands, and ancillaries around it. So all of them are not tech heavy, right? The idea is that there will be different domains of early stage startups. One of them is tech.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, everything nowadays has to be tech enabled. That's a different piece to it. So every business in general, you would want them to be tech enabled and digitally sound and using the latest technology to create what they're creating. That is fine. But you cannot expect every business to be a Google or an Oracle, right? Or Microsoft.
I agree.
There will be brands needed. There would be lifestyle things needed for you to create value in the world, right? So there are 100 different industries, maybe more than that, wherein disruption is possible through either brand innovation, through product innovation, or through whatever. So just that a tech business can grow infinitely because of the operating leverage by default, how a tech business has. A traditional business might not have that. So obviously, when you talk about valuing these two offers, you will pay higher for one and you will pay lower for someone else, right? Taking our example of that auto rickshaw again, so you will be ready to pay more money with a car being driven at 100 km/h versus an auto, because you know that this 100 km/h car is going to have that additional layer of safety or whatever. It can have better benefits for me. Yeah. So I think it's not fair to say that early stage would only be tech. It could be anything. Okay, a layer of tech enablement, that's fair to assume.
Mm-hmm. Understood. I think my view of like what is called a startup is so influenced by like maybe TechCrunch,
yeah,
or
Crunchbase, or
yeah, or like reading about companies in The Verge, maybe, where you only get to see like high tech or deep tech startups,
yeah.
And when somebody, or when I see like startups in, let's say, Shark Tank,
yeah,
like pitching for chips.
Yeah.
I'm like, that is not a startup. How can that be a startup?
Yeah, so see, again, what that person is trying to achieve is it's competing against giants like, say, Lay's or
Haldirams
or Bikaji. And it's trying to disrupt the market quickly. So anywhere where we think about disruption, category creation, trying to create a product which does not exist, it could be even, say, I'm sure you've heard of that latest brand called Death, which sells water.
Okay.
So it's rebranding of this usual water, right? But what is so disruptive? It's about the packaging disruption. So it's crazy numbers, right? It's selling of millions of dollars now. So point is, will you call that a startup? Yes, because liquid death is what they call it. And they've repackaged it into a can looking like an alcoholic beverage, but it's just water.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's created that whole ecosystem, community of like-minded people trying to have that water. But point is, what was there to disrupt in water? Is the most common commodity. But this startup comes in, creates a packaging innovation over it, creates a marketing innovation over it, and it's still a startup. So I think it could be tech, it could be non-tech, but the moment you talk about quick disruption by default is quick, but the moment you're thinking about disruption, you're thinking about creating value, trying to displace existing legacies. I think that's where the startup definition should fit in.
Even if the product that you're selling is, let's say, non-tech, let's say Coca-Cola or Lay's maybe.
Yeah.
But if it is posing a threat, or if it's like eating the bigger players' market share, then that can be. That's also like, if you're going to that market, that's also like.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be tech per se.
It doesn't have to be tech per se. Although the maximum, you're thinking about returns, that the maximum return possibility is in tech, but obviously if you're thinking about as your own portfolio, right, you would want tech, you would want non-tech, you would want everything. But when you're talking about funds, every fund will have their own philosophy which they understand or they've been surrounded by, so they would only choose that sector.
Understood.
But it doesn't mean that only tech is startup.
I just want to push this further and sure. close is just on the return side, like the way I was thinking about this was like scale wise, like initially I thought like tech products can also scale, but even Lay's can scale, right? In the sense that Lay's also like everybody can like every person can eat Lay's, right?
Yeah,
every
yeah.
person can eat chips
yes.
or chocolates. Chocolates may not have such a large, but but the returns wise, tech businesses will have like outsized returns than compared to, let's say, these kind
yes.
of businesses, right?
Yes, returns could be outsized, and maybe the time frame of returns could be different, wherein although say you make 100x return on a brand like chips, you take 20 years for that, for example, just to give an example. Maybe in tech it is possible in 2-3 years.
Okay.
Because
okay.
the kind of disruption that it would create, it would be so huge. So for example, just again, because OpenAI is in or everywhere, right? So in 5 years, 6 years, the kind of disruption they would have created,
yeah,
obviously that you cannot expect from a chips manufacturer.
I think it's valued at $30 billion, is it? I don't know.
Yeah, it's like it's gone from zero to wherever it
yeah,
is, right?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
and large companies investing and they don't even have a profit motive. So point is that cannot be expected from some other industry, because the reach, the operating leverage which tech provides as a business model is obviously unique. But on the flip side, when it's more about probability, right? The more returns possible, the higher is the chance of failure for tech companies.
I mean, I can't imagine, like, no matter what kind of chips, no matter what my grandmother's recipe for banana chips might be, I don't imagine it being like a $50 billion startup. And like,
so it can be. We don't know what marketing innovation will
really?
Be. Whether it will be in India or not. So that's what I just told you. Liquid death. Who would have thought they can sell like $300-400 million worth of water
okay.
just through this innovation? So it can sell. And what point in time were you? So for example, you invested at say $10 million valuation in this company, and it goes to $3 billion valuation in say 7 years, you make a lot of money, right?
Okay.
So it need not be tech. With tech, a lot of things need to go right, and the chances of, as I told you, the probability of failure is always high.
Mm-hmm.
because they're trying to create something, disrupts something so difficult, it might work, it might not work.
So initially, when I brought up my mother example,
yeah.
and when I told you that, you know, if she wanted to invest, like one thing that we kind of spoke about was the biggest bottleneck was like money. So in the sense that the way I was approaching that, I think in the US at least, not everybody can be an investor. No, I mean, I think they have some accreditation and then
so,
only...
So regulatory wise, there are various accreditations in terms of who can be an investor into a fund.
Uh-huh.
But nothing stops an individual from investing in a company directly.
Okay. Even early stages.
Even early stage. So early stage is a human definition, right? So how does the government know whether it's an early... Why is this company formed?
Understood.
Whether it's early stage, whether it's tech, will only be known gradually. So I think there is no restriction per se. Obviously, there are checks and balances and disclosures, but there's no limitation to invest in a company.
Are there any, like, when does a company decide, like, when to go? Like, when I think about public market companies or listed companies, I tend to think of them like decently mature businesses, and that's why they are, like, kind of listed.
Yeah.
So predictability is one thing, but also IPO, at least in my mind, as an average person, like, I feel like, I mean, somebody's vetted them, somebody has gone through their financials,
mm-hmm.
and they must, they might be like a relatively safe bet rather than, let's say, are there any advantages where companies choose to go public? Is that like the final destination? Is that like a desire, and why so?
Yeah, so I think a lot of, so without the venture capital ecosystem, so that's very fairly new in India, right? And even in the US, obviously, the public market part is, there are two reasons. One is you go to the public markets when you need to raise more money. And second reason could be that you need to find the value of the business that you created. So as long as you are private, till the time you're private, it's all, there's no fixed mark, fixed valuation for your business, right? Someone might say your business is worth 10 rupees, someone might say it's worth 100 rupees, someone might say it's worth 50 rupees. So the final calling is when you go and list on an exchange is the real test of what your business is valued at, really. Yeah. So there are two reasons. One is you raise money. Second is you want to know what your valuation is. And third is obviously there with the new age trend coming up, wherein there are a lot of investors who already invested in you at an early stage. So they want to now cash out the money that they invested in. So how do they do it? They cannot, if they go to the public, it's the fastest way in terms of trying to figure out, you're not selling it to a single person, there's a group of people buying your thing, and in the interim you're also creating value by having a market cap attached to the company. So that's with the public market. But your idea that all companies listed are matured is not true.
Okay.
Basically, they came in at various points in time in history, right? And all businesses do not continue to do well.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are disrupted by government policy. Some of them are disrupted by industry innovations. Some businesses have gone obsolete. Some businesses, family disputes happened.
I'm also thinking about examples like Paytm and Zomato. I think when they listed, they were not profitable businesses.
Yeah, they were not.
They were still loss-making businesses.
Yes. So Zomato just came out with...
I heard yesterday they made a profit.
The first time they made profits. Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah. So that's what I'm trying to say, that early stage companies getting listed is a different thing. Traditional cement, sugar, rice, alcohol, these companies getting listed is a different ball game altogether, right? So in the past, the first number which I told you, that currently say 4,000-5,000 companies are trading on the Bombay Stock Exchange. So they came in at various points in time in history. Now some came in when, so for example, textile was upcoming sector in say 80s, and they became big, but then they were disrupted by say Dhaka or Vietnam or China. So they slowly started losing track, and if they did not innovate, or the family was not excited enough to innovate, right? Rather, the second generation was happy being rich. There was no passion to do
rent-seeking money.
Yeah. So yeah, so they just collapsed, but they did not. So there's a famous book called Dead Companies Walking. So it basically means that companies can remain languishing for years. They do not.
Really?
Yeah, languishing as in, because they'll sell something, right? And they'll be listed forever, because there's no rule that you stop being listed unless you're following all the rules which the exchange is giving you. You're giving your results on time, you're disclosing everything to the public, which you think is necessary. So you keep getting, you keep being listed, but now you're no longer a large company. And that is where, when this point of a small company becoming big versus a big company shrinking down in size and becoming a microcap.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where we come to the point of where does the opportunity lie, and what is the similarity and the difference between how an investment in a microcap and an early stage startup is. It has its own similarity. There are some similarities, some differences, but what we are talking about, that both are small companies. So that's the similarity. Although an early stage is trying to create value through disruption, the other company maybe was, could never grow beyond a particular scale, or it was large at one point in time, now it became small. So from an, for example, you had some money to invest and you were given an option in two small companies without knowing the legacy. Both companies are small. You choose that which is basis your risk appetite, what works, whether company A works or company B works. Both are valued at the same number. But only when you dig deeper, you realize that A has a huge legacy, wherein they came in, they was it was formed in, say, the 70s, it tried various business in the 80s, it tried, it was a big one in 90s, then it collapsed in early 2000. Now the third generation has come in, they are trying to do something unique. So should I place a bet on this already listed company or this young company which promises me something? So that's where, from an investor's perspective, this is the similarity between the two. Now, obviously the difference is the listed one has legacy most of the time, sometimes it might not, but it has some numbers attached to it, some matrix attached to it, which creates that dilemma that should I get into valuing it basis numbers, or should I stick to my psychological analysis of this young company? Because I think early stage startups, or startups by default, derive their valuation through psychological reasoning, right? So there, although people try to put numbers to it, but ultimately, if you, what you realize is that businesses in general, they, their value is, although numbers speak for themselves, but keeping the numbers same. For example, you have, you earn 500 rupees and I earn 500 rupees. The perception, what I portray versus what you portray, might be different, and someone might be ready to give more valuation to my 500 rupees versus your 500 rupees, because maybe I've convinced them enough that this 500 rupees is different, and I might tell them that, okay, this 500 rupees I'll take you to the moon, and you are still promising them only a coffee. So that's the difference. So by default, valuation is a mixture of numbers and psychology. The problem with early stage startups is that most of the time there will be no numbers initially. So it, so what I try to, what I'm trying to explain is the equation is always psychological plus numbers. Now, what exists where is obviously case to case differentiation.
So, like, in terms of like, maybe this is a bad example, but so I have heard that the skills required for a company to maybe take the company from zero to one, as opposed to one to N, sometimes it'll be a different set of skills. Like, let's say there's a person who is able to start things and maybe get them off the ground and up to a certain scale, let's say, I don't know, 100 employees, 150 employees.
Sure.
But when it comes to like 250 to, let's say, 25,000 employees, the skill set kind of mismatch. I'm trying to connect that to, let's say, investing in, let's say, early stage versus micro caps or maybe larger companies as well. Is there like a significant offloading of like some amount of intuitions that might work in early stage? Do they kind of break down in microcaps as well, or do you think they are very stable?
Yeah, so that's what the point is, that microcaps are, as I said, there are two reasons why a microcap company exists. Either it started small and it remained small, or it started big and it collapsed for various reasons, or it has been very few years where it got listed, right? So in various scenarios, this is still a small company. Although because of the numbers it has presented, I inherently feel that the probability of failure is low. And that's a fact, because they've been growing at a smaller scale, or they are at a scale wherein they are not chasing innovation. Maybe they are chasing profits, or they are chasing trying to restructure the business so that they get profits in the future. That's their aim. With early stage, although ultimately every company should be profitable, that's a separate argument. But with early stage, as you said, the 0 to 1 is a larger mindset. But although a lot of companies are actually doing 1 to N, but they're portraying themselves as 0 to 1, that's where the failure of investments happen, right? Like you,
what do you mean?
Wherein you think that this particular company is trying to disrupt something, but what they're trying to do is only scale up an existing, for example, chips. It's not a 0 to 1 game, right? And if you, in your head, you've created that story for your own self that, okay, no, this is 0 to 1 problem, which I'm trying to solve. But ultimately, what you're trying to do is go from 1 to N and try to do it in a different way versus what the other is doing. And so with microcaps, the point is that there are a plethora of business in microcaps. It could be tech, it could be lifestyle, it could be commodity. What you're trying to figure out is that there are two small businesses available in front of you. Where do I get my biggest return from? So for example, I tell you that I'm offering you, say, a cement factory, and you don't understand anything about cement, right? Nor do we understand how, say, for someone like me, say, how an AI model works. So I'm equally not there in terms of going deep into understanding the business, but I know for a fact that I can jot down some numbers and figure out what is this building worth. So for example, let's take this point wherein there is a single factory, single unit. I crunched a lot of numbers. I figured out, wow, this is worth, say, 150 crores. And then I go and check the valuation of this company is just 30 crores. So I ask myself, what the hell is happening? Then Ryan comes up to me and says, oh, hey, Bhavik, there is this 30 crore early stage company which has just thought of a unique model to disrupt the way podcasts are done. So, okay, then I start evaluating, and this young guy tells me, okay, I'm going to disrupt it. But here is the blank slate, and I'm worth 30 crore rupees. So then again, I go back to my auto rickshaw example that, okay, wow, this guy is going to take me faster because he's going in from some innovation, disruption. So now I'm left choosing, where do I put my money into? Whether it's this 5 lakhs or here? Do I put 5 lakhs here? Do I put 5 lakhs there? So then I start thinking that what is my end game with money? I want to earn returns, and I want to earn it with a higher probability. That's where I try asking this guy, what unique business are you trying to do? So he says that, okay, I've just thought of an idea, and I'm going to work on it. I'm going to create a product after 2 years, which will then start selling and then start creating value for everyone. And then I said, what does this mean? That he said, I'm at a pre-seed stage. So, okay, then I start wondering, why is it worth 30 crores? Wherein I'm getting a 150 crore factory for 30 crores. So what do I choose? It's a big dilemma, right, in my head. So that's where, when I keep meeting a lot of early stage companies, I keep meeting, then I realize that, is this the 0 to 1 game or is it the 1 to N game? Mm-hmm. Now, the moment I have figured, okay, what this guy is doing is actually so disruptive that he achieves that in 2 years, then his or her business is worth, say, 500 crores. And obviously there is no guarantee for that. But on the other side, there's this 150 crore factory available for 30 crore. And I'm 100% sure through my multiple iterations, conversations, that I've met the various people, that this is surely worth 150 crore. Then I ask myself, then why the hell is it at 30 crore? Again, I go back to my example of the auto rickshaw, because this guy wants to go at 30 kmph. And maybe because of his legacy, it's like familiarity breeds contempt. And people have known this person enough to figure out, okay, he's not going to do anything with this 150 crore factory. What do I do by getting this factory? It's not that I'm going to buy the whole factory up, right? I'm just buying one share into his company. So that's where I try to connect. I try to go deeper, deeper and deeper. Then I again go to this early stage guy, the pre-seed guy. I said, why don't you value your business at, say, 10 crore? And he gets spooked. Why? Because he wants a crore. And at first day of his job, he ends up giving away 10% of his business. Then he is he's worried that what will happen next. But anyway, then I convince him enough that, okay, you are only worth 10 crore today. So, and he needs some money, but he has a blank slate. And because I want to be surprised, I'm ready to give him at say a 5 lakh rupee check at 10 crore valuation. And I say, okay, wow. Now either I become 500 crore, I become zero. On the other hand, when I go to this cement example, I try to dig deeper and figure out that, okay, it's not as bad. The perception is driven by lot of, as you say, past beliefs. Is it true or not? Let's figure out. So I go and meet the person who is in charge of this factory. He's saying that my great-grandfather started. His idea was to earn money. He was trying to run this business as a family business. And then someone told him, let's get listed. He got listed. But ultimately, he came from very humble background. So he wanted to make as much money for his family. And he did that. But in that drive, obviously, he did not scale. Or maybe he was not as transparent in his accounting. I don't know. But now I'm here. This is the first factory. And I'll make sure this runs well. And then I go to buy another factory. So then I say, okay, wow, this guy seems convincible. And I've just given my 5 lakh rupees to someone who doesn't even have a product. And at the same, at a valuation maybe, and I had to convince him that, oh, please take it at 10 crore. And it was so difficult to convince him. But ultimately, I gave him that money. And here is a person who has the physical asset, the only asset in the world, which is limited land. And he has built a factory on top of it, and he's running a business, and maybe he's saying, okay, I'll be profitable. So there's no harm in believing in him, right? Because mm-hmm. I've spoken to him. So all my past biases, not my biases, but the biases with the people in general have created against him, I think it's worth taking a bet on this.
This model of what you have just explained, it's not scalable to a retail investor, no? Is it?
It is. It's available for anyone to buy.
I don't know. What I'm saying is, but the amount of, talking that you had to do, and, you know, the kind of interactions that you had to make. Like, if I was a retail investor and if I had, a 9-to-5 job,
okay.
It's very difficult.
So, okay, you mean access to management.
Correct.
So let's remove that talking part out of it. Here, early stage, I have a lot of access.
Correct.
So that's one of the differences between, say, a public market and a private company, where you can speak to the founder because, okay, wow, you're investing money. And you can speak to someone who has invested, who knows the founder, and you can get data. But here, suppose you do not meet the management. You just do a basic Google search, cement factory, this area, what is it worth, how much can it make? And also, this guy has been giving results every 3 months. This person, this founder, this promoter is giving his books of accounts every 3 months to you. So you go and read them suppose I did the reading of the past 12 quarters, basically that means 3-4 years, what this guy's up to. And I see that he's actually improving his business, reducing his costs, and people are not noticing this part because it's such a lousy business. Why do I go there and see? So I see that. I do not interact, for the time being, let's take the interaction out. And I see, okay, wow, this, if I'm assuming it to be 150 crore, let me see for 3-4 months, let me do more work. And I go to my friend who has a factory and he knows someone, I go to someone else, okay, hey, how much should this company be worth, this factory should be worth? He said, easily 100 crores. And I started with my notion of 150, okay, I'm not very off, so I'm at 100. So still, it's available at 30% of what its real value is. Okay, then my question is that, will it keep languishing as it was with his great grandfather? Then I try to figure out, okay, the person's intent seems positive. He's getting into motion. It's not that he's hiding like a turtle or tortoise somewhere under the sand. So let's take a bet. I've given 5 lakhs to the early stage founder. I've given 5 lakhs to this company. Okay, so let's see after 3 years what happens.
So this seems like at least to me, the way you've described it feels like looking for a gem where everybody's kind of discarded or not paying attention.
There is just one form of it. The way early stage, tech is one form, brands is one form. Now, gems is a word which is it's more a marketing thing, right? Like you find that hidden gem.
Huh.
So that is more of an term.
No, in that sense, I think gem is the wrong word. Like what the sentiment I was trying to convey was these financial reports you're talking about. If we leave the interaction out, like the financial reports are available to everyone.
Yes.
And it's like news, right? Like news is available. Like news published is available. Technically, it's available to everyone.
Everyone, but not everyone makes most of it.
Correct.
Yes,
So. There you're trying to take advantage, like your differentiator is you're actually pouring through those reports and like analyzing them. And
I'm going beyond psychology.
Correct.
Yeah, because in the early stage thing, I do not have anything beyond psychological motivation, right? Because I have to believe that person, I have to believe the technology. Okay, he will tell me 100 things, 100 research papers, but ultimately I'm not the operator. I do not understand all those research papers beyond a point, right? I can like read them for validation. But again, I'm placing my confidence on the person and his vision or her vision. And then I'm validating it with discussing it various other folks.
Yeah.
Here, I already have some numbers. Now, the psychological part is now what I'm... First is the numbers are speaking that there is some improvement. Second is now I'm thinking that, okay, what if this person sets up another factory with the money he generates? What if that happens? Can this be a case wherein... This 30 crore, although one, it's already at 30% of versus a rupee, right? And if something more happens here, can this be worth, say, 500 rupees? And I'm seeing it lying right now at 30 rupees. So let's take equal bets on both for now. One is completely blue sky scenario. One is something tangible. In this case, at least, if something goes wrong, I do not, at best, I lose some money. That's okay. So I think that's what I'm trying to explain is the similarities and the differences in terms of the company size, the promoter trying to change something versus the promoter trying to innovate something. Now, as you said that, how does the retail understand or how does someone go and read? Obviously, you have to read more and more about, interact more and more with other people. And this is one case wherein it's a case of undervalued asset, which we were trying to point out. There could be another case, for example, this same company was run by, say, Ryan for years. It didn't do well for whatever reason.
It will not do well.
No, I'm just giving an example because Ryan is more interested in tech.
Okay.
Yeah. Please. Ryan is more interested in tech. Then suddenly Ryan's friend or Ryan finds another buyer of this factory. And that guy says, hey, I've been doing this for years now. Give this factory to me. I'll show the world what I can do. Now, suddenly this new guy steps in and... People are, again, the psychological part starts. Till now, it was a slate full of words, very confusing. Now, suddenly, this new guy comes in and says, oh, wow, I can change the fortunes. And again, there is no legacy attached to this new guy, at least in terms of being with this company. Maybe he did something else in his past, which you can go and verify. So you say, okay, wow, this new guy's come in. Obviously, he's come in. He has some intention to move. So, okay, now definitely I'm buying this. So let me put my 5 lakhs here and let me put my 5 lakhs here. And I keep doing such iterations again and again and again to create a portfolio of large companies, small companies, very small companies, early stage companies. And what happens is, okay, 5 years from here, this guy has succeeded in on his, what he was promising. He created one more factory and now he has a very good perception. So now people value him as a person who can ride faster. So after 5 years, this company is worth now 500 crores. And what happened is I made my money. Now here, the podcast thing didn't work out. The technology didn't work out. So I lost my money. Now, against that, maybe I did four or five such investments when one founder made it to the top and I made my 500 crores worth of valuation there. And in microcaps, again, I keep doing it, keep researching, keep doing it, and I keep finding those, say, 50 crore, 70 crore, 80 crore, 90 crore, 100 crore companies, or 400 crore companies, where there is change in perception, change in the promoter maybe, or change in government policy, you never know. Maybe a company who's manufacturing, say, as simple products like a foundry, but suddenly government says, okay, we want to push indigenous technologies, and this factory is in an area where we want to make better the life of the people in this area. So let's give them some incentives. So there could be various reasons why small companies they get suddenly pushed into a trajectory which will create value.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think in the interest of time, I've just given few examples. Now, this is the similarity and the difference which I'm talking about between early stage and microcaps. The distinct similarity is that, again, you're trying to bet on the promoter either improving things or disrupting things. And on one end, there is a blue sky scenario. It's a completely blank slate. On the other end, there was a lot of scribbling there. Now you have to see through all those words, which maybe someone else won't do, and you create value through that. So I think this is what microcap versus early stages. And in general, as you asked me that, what exactly is public equities? Are they all matured? Yes, they should be, but they are not, unfortunately, for various reasons. Because what we read in news is only the top ones, right? Like Reliance or Mahindra or Axis Bank, ICICI Bank, and maybe, say, smaller companies like, I don't know, if you would know about Tata Motors, right? But you would not know about, say, a company called JBM Auto.
Mm-hmm.
Both make buses, and obviously Tata makes 100 other things. But JBM Auto, I took that example because I think long back, it was available at a valuation of, maybe it was early 2013, wherein I had very limited amount of money to deploy, right? And I bought this company at a valuation of 80 crore. It was an auto ancillary company making various parts for maybe buses, and so long back. And I thought, okay, makes sense, 80 crore, so much just available. Maybe that time I was too hooked up on price to earning multiple, because that's what we learned in books, right? So I said, okay, if it's available at 6x, wow, I can make a fortune out of it. So I bought that, and I sold it when it went 10x in a span of, I sold most of it, yep. In a span of not even 18 months maybe.
Oh, okay.
18 months or 24 months, I forget that. But yeah, it did go because it was so cheap. And I thought, okay, the promoters are changing things, the industry around it is changing. And today it's worth 14,000 crores, that company. And so I could keep only very small fraction of it. And then, because I was wondering what the hell is happening. I thought this, but then they started making EV buses. The EV policy just changed the game. They became a big player in EV,
mm-hmm.
Supplying to governments, doing exports, doing JVs. So today, practically, that company would be more than 150 times of its valuation in a span of 8 years.
Is that your biggest regret?
Yeah, there are more. So more such regrets.
Okay.
But
is that the biggest one?
Yeah, one of the biggest. So I couldn't cap.
I'm so sorry, but you're saying there are more in your portfolio where it's almost on the same amount, is it? Like where you've lost. I mean, not lost, but it's opportunity.
Opportunity. Yes. Yeah. There are. So again, there was a company called Swiss Glass Coat. So why are they unique? Is again available at say very. I remember the stock price then. It was $33. It used to make glass liners for factories, and I didn't understand too much of technology behind it. But I realized that this company pays almost 10% dividends. So if I put in 10,000 rupees, I can get 1,000 rupees every year from them. Plus, it's available at 5x price to earning multiple. And I kept wondering, what is it that I'm missing? So limited resources, limited understanding of how infinite growth can be. So I put in some amount at 33. And I think today, 33 rupees per share.
Okay.
Again, sold out fairly quickly because I thought, okay, this is it. 5-6x is good.
Sorry, I didn't understand. What do you mean sold out?
Sold out means I sold my shares.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I sold my shares. I'd say whatever I could understand that, okay, wow. And I think that went on to become 10,000 rupees or something. It got acquired by someone. It became HLE Glass Coat. So that is the potential of microcaps as well. You can create, obviously you don't get it every day, but if you keep doing it, there is enough opportunity on both the sides wherein the impact of disruption and a new person running a business is huge always, whether it's microcap or whether it's early stage. So There are many such examples. There is one more company, I don't know if you've heard of it, it's called Tasty Bite Eatables. Again, it used to make B2B for kitchens, restaurants. They used to supply ingredients to make their meals, right? And they used to also make ready-to-eat, ready-to-cook meals, and they used to export it to US. I remember the stock price, again, was maybe 90 rupees. Again, I had bought some. And you can guess the price today.
I can't.
It's 10,000 rupees.
Oh my.
Because it got acquired by Mars, the chocolate maker.
But I don't want to flatter you too much as well, but it seems like your analysis is on point, but execution wise.
Yeah, because see, that's what I'm trying to explain, that it's all a psychological bottleneck. So there have been some good ones wherein, so how much I made and all, this is obviously, this is not a finance program, but I'll just try to give the. I write a blog called Watch List, Weekly Watch List, and then I covered a company called Sangam Advisors. It was available at 38 crore market cap, 38 crore valuation, and someone had acquired a solar company called Wari Energy had acquired them, but and the old company was dead, so it was like a dead company walking kind of a thing, and this new promoter comes in. For 2 years, the new promoter does nothing. People get excited, okay, new car, speed, but the new promoter does nothing. It fails, goes down to 38 crore market cap. And that's where I see its annual report, where it says it has plans to, I don't know, for whatever reason, they ended up writing that, okay, we want to do 800 megawatt work of solar rooftops and all that. I said, no way this is a 38 crore company. No way, because this promoter has... The founder has a company which does 1500 crores of revenue, another company, and this company cannot be 38 crore. So today, in a span of 2 years, its valuation is 2500 crore.
Okay.
And I learned, and I didn't go out too soon, to say the least. Like, I encashed a lot of it.
Okay. So you bet heavily on it, and you were able to capture the value.
The full maybe, but Imagine from the JBM story of 100x, the Swiss Glass Coat story of 100x, the Tasty Bite Eatable story of 150x.
Mm-hmm.
So point is, you just need one search in your life, right?
Correct.
And whether it's the early stage or it's microcaps, does it matter? Because it's not that one is dirty money and one is bad, right?
Yeah.
So ethically, you should be neutral to both. And you, and with early stage, the point is that the retail access part, which you said, it's a big problem with early stage companies, because a good company would always want larger names.
Correct.
And you are not the large name.
Correct.
For sure. And larger names means big funds, big investors, some prominent names. So where do you get in there? You can get in through platforms, but see, point is that something which is so good, you inherently start thinking, why is this company taking money from me?
Mm-hmm.
Because am I that valuable to that company? Mm-hmm. At least in early stage disruption. Obviously, slowly when you come of age and you are so valuable to someone that someone wants you to put money and trusts you and respects you. But with microcaps, the thing is, it's open to the world. There's no limitation.
I was really curious about when you found these, like when you were doing this analysis, I assume you go through a lot of reports.
Yeah.
Then, no? Like,
yeah,
how much
I do.
Time do you spend on like reading like a report?
Yeah, so I
and
think
how often do you do it as well?
Yeah, I think maybe every day an hour at least. So it's not my day job is being part of this fund and the investment team and trying to manage the operations, various things. But my passion is, so equity is what I like. And there were times where I had no other responsibilities maybe. Then I used to spend like maybe 2-3 hours every day reading annual reports, reading this, that, and casually. So maybe I'm one of the random folks. I'll just go, maybe I'm traveling now, I'll read something in the air.
By something you mean annual reports?
Annual reports, numbers, maybe some articles, something which someone has written which I'm not aware of.
But can I ask you, like,
reading maybe.
In the sense like, I feel like articles, if you read, it'll be like a narrative, no? In the sense, like, they'll weave their own narrative.
Yeah,
you
but
don't
it's a starting point. Now, so that's where your experience comes into picture to cut the noise out.
Correct.
And so that can only happen through multiple iterations. So someone who says that I've found the secret formula in day one, maybe he or she has just got lucky. So see, point is ultimately, whether it's microcap, early stage, your fortunes play a large role in your success, right? That's always there.
By fortunes, you mean your ability to deploy money?
Yeah, deploy money, right place, right time, your stars aligning to that extent. So if we put the luck part outside the gambit of all of this, obviously luck plays a big part in sometimes you think this is, say, JBM Auto, I thought maybe it's worth 1,000 crore, but it ended up being 14,000 crore. For argument's sake, if I still had that company in my portfolio, maybe I had in some form, but if I had it, I could have created a story around it. That I was the one visionary. Yeah. So, but that might not be true. So that is like selling a hope story, right? That I can create. But if I say that this iteration process can get you that much return.
I actually disagree with you there in the sense that I feel like this is an extreme example, but the only example, I feel like Warren Buffett's way of approaching businesses, I don't know, I find that pretty sound, like, in the sense, like, and also, okay, let's remove Warren Buffett out of the picture. Even with you, this is very tricky. In the sense that, okay, let me finish the argument and I'll tell you why there is a flaw in my argument. So if you're able to do analysis and your analysis consists of you doing step one, step two, step three, and now after doing these three steps, you're able to find like four or five companies, and all those companies may not be billion dollar companies or whatever, but they're able to generate like, let's say, they're able to beat like average S&P 500 or NASDAQ, I don't know, the NSE 50, whatever.
Sensex Nifty.
Yeah, correct. Sensex Nifty. They're able to beat that number. Then I feel you have something going on.
Yeah.
Now that is my thesis, but the argument against that is, which some people like to claim, I don't know if I buy this completely, is that there are so many people playing the stock market, or
they're trying to create value through investing.
Correct.
So why are not people successful if it's so obvious? That's
In the sense that when so many people are playing that game, there are bound to be some winners.
Yeah.
And it may be through pure luck as well, and we are just fitting the numbers to fit.
That's the survivorship bias.
Correct. That's the exact.
So So that will be there. Survivorship. So I've only spoken about, say, four successful stories. So to get to these four, you will have to face 20 unsuccessful stories as well. Now with time, your target is to reduce the improve your success ratio, basically. And I'm not saying I'll only do micro cap. I'll do large, I'll do mid, I'll do small. But when it comes to taking risks, disproportionate risks, I'll try to evaluate these companies on an ongoing basis, wherein where can I find this value gap? And suppose if you have 1,000 rupees, you only allocated 100 rupees to this, say 200 rupees. And if you are at an early stage of your life and you don't have anything else to lose, right? So you'll say, okay, let me bet 400 rupees on this. And in this 400, initially, you'll only find 5, 6, 7 companies. Suppose you find 10 such companies, and out of those 10, only 3 do disproportionately well. Then you're sorted. So maybe there is one other way of that Warren Buffett is managing money. He started his career managing money for the wealthy, right? Ultimately, he was a fund advisor or investment advisor or investment manager. He created his own money through these value gaps, and then he started managing money for others. So ultimately, he found these companies trading below their asset values and replacement values, and that's where he invested in various companies. Either they have network effects, or so he grew in his thesis as his wealth grew. Obviously, once out from your 1,000 rupees, you make $1 million, your approach might change, because you would want to take less risks, or maybe if you don't want to make $1 billion, you'll decide, now what do I want to do?
So, like, I think I've heard Warren talk about now they're at such a scale and they have so much money that I think their problem is starting to become, at that scale, like, how to deploy capital.
Yes.
Like, they're finding difficult to find like good businesses to invest
and
in.
And luckily or unluckily, we don't have that problem.
Okay.
So we can choose whatever ethically takes us to our goal faster. Now that sometimes the goal, as you would know, it keeps changing as you progress in life, you need more, right? So that is more on the philosophical side. But anyway, point is that there are various such companies lying here, and there are a host of early stage startups also there who will disrupt and innovate. So I think maybe if someone cannot reach the early stage companies, they should at least try and evaluate these listed companies, which because see, I was not a finance wizard or something, right? I just kept reading more and more about them.
No, but that you're actually discounting in the sense that what even though you're not a finance whiz, which I just have to take your claim for it. You claim to be not a finance whiz. But anyways, even if I accept that at face value, like the ability to just, when you're going on like trips and what you're doing is like reading finance reports or articles.
Yeah, one of them.
That's a trait that most people will not have, yeah, right? Like most people watch like Netflix or YouTube.
Yeah, so Netflix, YouTube is also there. I'm saying that, I'm not a stoic that I'll not do anything, but I'm doing a mix of a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is maybe reactive reading towards this. And I've reached this reactive reading stage because maybe proactively I did something long back, which I have now over the years learned.
Sorry, what do you mean proactive reading and reactive?
Proactive as in like dedicating time for this every day. That's not what I'm doing now.
Okay.
It's more reactive. Someone tells you something or you go to some place and you realize, okay, let's read this. More reactive. Proactive means, okay, you set up 3 hours a day.
You're waiting for someone and there's some time and
yeah,
then you pick up
and
something.
And you're reading and you're looking at it. So that's not what I'm doing.
Okay.
So obviously someone who comes in new might have to do that. But the point being that I've seen people who have zero financial background. They've exceedingly done well, even way better than me. Because they had that curiosity and that psychological ability to read between lines, it is what is the psychological meaning of what is happening, right? And they were not, so I know for a fact there's a person in near your hometown, Udupi itself. He was a software engineer. He had zero knowledge of finance, but he kept reading these microcaps like crazy. And he kept figuring out what the hell is happening here. Why not? Let's buy. Now I know in the past 7 years, maybe he's not told me exactly, but maybe he's made 30-40x for himself without having any financial education. Obviously, mm-hmm. he's an engineer from NIT, so he has that ability to understand things. That is very clear. But that most of us have. So I think it's more than finance. It's about trying to know that something like this exists.
And I think the drive to make money also helps, I think.
Yeah, and drive to make money and drive to be maybe accurately right again and again.
Correct.
And again. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah, and so obviously this conversation is because there is a drive to make money, right? Because when we're talking about startups, companies, you're anyway investing your money to create value for yourself. So anyone who says against that is just trying to get away from the fact that you are doing investments, such investments, whether it's early stage or direct equity. The idea is to create money with low amount of risk. That's, I think, even your idea. When you say you have invested in Tesla,
correct.
Your idea was to create value for yourself. And obviously, it had that unique factor of owning a company like Tesla.
Correct.
That goes without saying. But ultimately, you want to make money out of that.
Correct.
Now, if I told you that the same money with some iteration, some process, you could buy it in India itself by buying 20 companies, you would be okay. Wow, this is possible. It's a great thing. So, I think drive to make money is obviously there, but ultimately it's about where do you put your energy, whether it's the larger companies lying there or the early stage startups trying to find that innovation disruption, which for that you know that a great company is not going to come to you. Why so? Because maybe there are hundreds of other people in queue before like they are ready to walk in. But here maybe exchanges, reading, it's free for you. Yeah, so you can just try figuring out what is good, what is bad. So that's where I do not get enough time to write my blog, but idea was to just give people these companies out, because I'm not a registered advisor. I don't want to manage people's money, right? But I want to give them these companies, whether it's early stage or early stage. Obviously now we are at a fund, so we have investors and we manage it professionally with proper thesis or allocations, because we want to create outsized returns in this format, But obviously, it takes a lot of effort to create outsized return in a venture capital fund, because you would be we evaluate maybe 100 companies a month,
mm-hmm.
and that's it can only happen through process and interactions, multiple interactions. So far we've done 22 investments. So these companies, each company would have met at least 10 times before deciding, okay, wow, this is
great. So far you mean like this year or like
no so in the past 5 years
that's what I was wondering.
Yeah, past 5 years, and we will do maybe 20 more in the next 2-3 years. So it's a process driven, maths driven, disruption driven thing. But as an individual investor, you could do a lot. That's what my idea was.
Like, so if we can move away from technicals and philosophize a little bit, in the sense that when I gave you the survivorship bias example, like where I was drawing most of it was from the famous Nassim's famous book,
yeah.
The Black Swan,
yeah.
where he compellingly makes the argument that, you know, most of it, like if I was to boil it down, most of it is absolute luck.
Yeah.
Like I am actually not convinced, like my thinking on, I'm not very convinced, at least Warren Buffett is obviously like the biggest influence, where Warren Buffett obviously is like the biggest influence, but also like some, even the guy who bet on Valiant, I'm thinking of like activist investors as well. But also like when I think about even your case where you know, some people where they have a thesis and or they have like some steps that they want to do, the steps that they take to kind of analyze, and then you know they make the purchases and then they you know they see some payoff. I feel like, I don't know, there must be some method to this madness rather than it being like pure.
So I think the luck part is what I say, that when I explained that, okay, I've spotted it, but holding it till the time it reaches its pinnacle, right? Like in JBM Auto or Tasty Bites, the luck part gets created there. So spotting it is a process. Iterative process can make you spot such ideas or spot such companies. But continuously monitoring, so point is that if you keep just spotting it and you're not doing anything about what you already have, then it's a problem, right? Again, so for example, if I had these two companies and I just held my focus only on this group of 5 or 6 companies, I didn't bother reading more, right? But because of that inherent bias in our mind that most part of it will fail, so I need to be ready with the next 5, right? So that's why you keep iterating and try to keep finding more and more names, and your luck plays a role wherein you end up selling these companies too soon, even after having spotted it. So that's where your luck, your psychological tilt plays a role. Whether you are happy with having these 10 companies, for example, I tell you that, okay, you bought Tesla, you buy 6 more, analyze, buy 6 more, and then don't do anything for 5 years. But inherent human nature tells you there's something wrong with this. So that's why you'll be ready for the future by 7 more names maybe. So you will say, okay, let me buy this 6 and let me have 7 more. So when you go to these 7 more, you realize that you have stopped reading about this 6 which you already have. And suddenly one fine day you see that couple of them are now 10 times, 20 times. You say, wow, my thesis played out, okay, let's sell it. So I remember such, I was very naive then, so I'm sure you're aware of Bajaj Finance.
Yeah.
So earlier in the days, it used to be, not early, so I'm not that old, but it used to be called Bajaj Auto Finance.
Okay.
And it was a auto finance company. But things were changing, good numbers, good results. I said, okay, let's buy it. So Bajaj Finance from that date till now is almost, I think, 200 times from maybe 2006, wherein at that time it was, I think, 200 rupees, and now post...
But that's almost 15 years. That's a long time.
No. Yeah, 15 years, 2007. Yeah. That time I was very naive, I told you that. I didn't... I just understood this is doing something great. So let's buy it. And then it became 5X. I got very happy. Then 5X in like... Wow, maybe again 18 months. I was like, wow. And I had invested, I think, my stipend or something into it. So... internship stipend or something, and I was like, wow, what the hell just happened? I'm a genius. So, and I sold it off, and because I was in the quest of finding seven more companies, and I kept reading about more because I thought that me making money means the company is not going to do well. So that has nothing to do with how the company is going to function, right? You made your 100x or 500x, that does not mean that the company is going to die.
Mm-hmm.
But inherently, when you make money, you feel that, okay, now either something has happened which is, okay, enough. So now I'm focused on these new seven ideas. Okay, let's find the next. So maybe that time I found JBM Auto or Tasty Bites or something else. But if I had just held on to what I had found and I kept it today, I would have been 200x. And maybe in the interim, obviously, I would have put in more money as I earned more salaries or whatever. And I could have found three or four more or six or seven. So I'm saying the iterative process is good. But the problem starts when you start discarding your old investments.
Mm-hmm.
Discarding in the sense you feel, okay, wow, I've spotted it, I'm a genius, they are doing well, okay, now I feel maybe at 20, 30, even if I would have sold, say, Bajaj Auto Finance, which later turned to Bajaj Finance, I'd say 20x, I would have been happy. But later on, I realized it's a machine. Kept doing well,
mm-hmm.
And from 200 rupees, maybe it's became what, 50,000 rupees or whatever that
it was. The goose that kept laying golden eggs.
But I was in the quest to find new gooses, maybe. So
you had the perfect girlfriend, you had the perfect wife, you still kept looking for this.
That beautiful girl, which kept arriving, but then you thought, okay, wow. So I think that's the part where luck or temperament,
right,
or psychological evaluation plays a part. That how do you create a balance between what you already have and what you are in the quest to, maybe either because you are, as an individual, you want to be challenged and you want to keep reading and find new ideas.
But does that give you, like, I mean, at this point you've mentioned like three ideas which have done 50x or 100x for you, which you have not like gone long. So does that give you like sleepless nights? By sleepless nights, I don't mean like literal sleepless nights where you're not sleeping the whole
night.
It does. Like sometime now and then when you get that intense feeling of like...
Yeah, sometimes it's like, again, what are you doing all this effort for? Maybe although you want to have a good life, you want to make the most of what you learned. But ultimately, if you miss out on such journeys, maybe you're delaying your achievements.
Correct.
You're dealing that achievement. So maybe one fine day over a cup of coffee, you'll ask me, okay, what's your biggest regret? Like most of the people would say, okay, marrying this person, or maybe having the child at the wrong time, taking the wrong job, being in the wrong industry. But point is, ultimately, you have, for you to be successful, there are two measures, obviously. One is that, okay, you are in a company, you founded a company, or you are in a company, you're going up the ranks, or you're doing all this to make money eventually. And you had this opportunity, ethical opportunity, without playing some lottery. And this could have, you could have already been there at the beach. But you're still sailing.
Right.
So that regret will give you sleepless nights a lot of times. But point is, nothing is ideal in the investment world. And that's where this iteration process of looking at companies, trying to, so out of say six ideas, maybe you sold three out of desperation, or you feeling that
right,
other three, if you could hold up and you could find seven more and create that balance, and maybe add a 10 more early stage companies into it. And so, and while you are also working, right, this is not what we do full time.
Correct.
While we're also working, and this, other people are working for you, in short, right, in a nutshell. So if you create that balance and you keep doing it, you creating the process wherein obviously luck can no longer fail you. Maybe it can fail you personally, personal life or whatever, but at least in the investment phase, because now you are sure that, okay, my luck, I'll go off in some, go right in some, but the moment I go right, that year is the year, or that 2 years are the year.
Mm.
So imagine if I could have, so I'm giving you very few examples, there are many more. These companies have grown crazily well, and it has happened in a decade. So I think that's, like, it would sound impossible to many, but this is the kind of opportunity which, at least, and microcaps are in every country, or early stage companies are in every company.
Mm-hmm.
There are various people writing about buying some Papua New Guinea bank or some Vietnamese microcap or so there are such companies everywhere.
Just to close this loop, in the sense, I'm sure you will know of people who may not do as intense reading as you might do,
yeah.
and may not go through finance reports, but may take somebody's advice or just randomly just pick something, and next thing you know they've retired. And does that kill you or
that does, that totally kills you in one form, because you are the one setting models and creating stuff.
Right.
And I know some such people who maybe bought on my advice itself.
Okay.
They held on to it.
Okay.
And they made a 50x, and they are very happy. And I know people who just they understood for a business which I would have taken say 6 months to figure out. Okay, this is the thing where I'll invest this much X rupees, Y rupees. But and I just met that person and explained it in 30 minutes, and they were more convinced than me. And they just took an outsized bet on that company. They believed in it. They held on to it, and they made disproportionate returns. So it does kill you. That's where the luck part comes into picture, right? Either, me meeting that person is also his luck, his or her luck.
So, right.
So 9 out of 10 times you will meet people who will not give you the right advice. Not intentionally, but just because they are not right in the way they have evaluated stuff. But I met some person, or some person was there around, and they figured it out, and just using the psychological method, they could just hold on to it and create that wealth. So unfortunately, maybe we don't have that advisor to us in life. So we can have, maybe you can create that ecosystem that you have such people, but ultimately then your dependency is high on believing in someone, right?
Right.
So you can...
That creates a new set of problems, actually.
Yeah, new set of problems, because every morning you're calling... depends upon your personality.
Correct.
Right? So for you to do that, at least if you have your own portfolio of ideas that you believe in, it's okay to take 2 or 3 from someone else. There's no harm in that.
Is like the factor of like too much knowledge also, like does that hamper? Like, I mean, sometimes...
Yeah.
When you mentioned somebody will be like with somebody will talk to you for like 30 minutes, and now they're convinced, and now they don't need any new information.
Yeah.
But sometimes you might be you have read like 30 reports or the last 10 years report.
Yeah, yeah.
And now there might be some confusion.
Happen? Analysis paralysis is always there.
Uh-huh.
And I think too much knowledge makes you a cynic, I think.
Uh-huh.
Because then you have so many benchmarks to break, and you're a cynic because, oh wow, this company cannot do that much.
So I'll give you one example.
You inherently become negative a lot of times.
So I don't know about negative, but I'll give you
cynic
one example.
Cynic is the right word.
I'll give you one example where, when I was working, I was a deep learning engineer, and we were dealing with GPUs, and for deep learning, you need a lot of GPUs.
Yeah.
And my team, we would always discuss we want the best GPUs, and we don't have GPUs, and we would hear a lot of talk as well about how to train deep learning models, you need GPUs, mm-hmm. and all that. I don't recall anyone investing in NVIDIA. Like NVIDIA, even though we knew everything, though we knew NVIDIA was the only company which had like a near monopoly on like producing GTX.
And AI has been in existence for so long. It was a matter of time.
Right.
It became a commodity in terms of some form, and NVIDIA was right in front of all our eyes. Right?
Right.
Like, we were trying to evaluate which is the next Google, next Microsoft, and like NVIDIA comes running. Hold my beer kind of a thing.
Is your thesis also like, is it fair for me to say that you, in India at least, you think microcaps are like severely undervalued or?
Yeah, so as and when more people are trying to understand this, obviously the valuation gap will narrow. But at any given point in time, there would be a set of companies which would be undervalued for various reasons. And there would lie an opportunity to find that one. So I'm saying, just for argument's sake, just although that is a very high number, take that 70% of your companies will not work. But because of the number of companies lying there idle and people neglecting these because they are only concerned with larger or maybe more prominent names, so there will always be such opportunities in India. And more so because retail is not that active in these microcaps. Retail wants to invest via hearsay or via
correct.
perception.
Correct.
The moment you tell a retail, like even you, if I tell you something, that this is the company, okay, you will feel there's this some Ponzi scheme going on.
So I'll tell you my perception of this, and I think you're accurate in the sense that I consider myself like an average person, no knowledge of like investing and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, I feel like if I have not heard of a company's name like publicly or on TV, right, I'm like, what is this? Is this a company? That brand value, I think, is very important. Like, or else I'll be hesitant to kind of.
Yeah, and even if you do, you'll restrict yourself.
Correct.
To the amount that you put.
There is this very very conservative, I think. I agree with you. But I don't
so
know
it's
if it's
more
my
than conservative, you're trying to protect your money.
Huh.
In because you feel that either I gain the knowledge or I find someone who has that knowledge and I trust that person, I till that time I rather stay away.
Right.
Basically you don't do what you don't know type kind of a personality. So I think that is right. But a lot of people who have been in the I've seen people making it their full-time job. It's scary, it's risky because there's no linear return kind of a model, right? Anyway, but point is they kept doing that iterative process so well and they were so confident that, okay, there will be that year where we will be done for life. And I've seen that happening in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I've not got to that stage yet because of maybe some temperament lapses, but it is a matter of time where if as you say that luck is a factor, whenever that factor aligns with, and obviously you're learning more, and obviously I've become better at it, way better at it. I've learned it and I've understood the material that I'm reading, the companies that I'm reading. I'm like maybe 100 times better in doing that. But obviously for some, this might be the stage where they get done with life. Maybe my aspirations are higher, so.
No, but I would assume that the base amount of capital also should be like is a big factor, right? Like, let's say you invest like 100 rupees and
yeah,
even if the company goes like
it is a big factor, but it is not the only factor.
Okay.
Maybe you need to balance your job and your investments or something like that. So, but at least there can be a start.
Okay, okay.
So my first investment, I think I remember I put 800 rupees
okay.
into the company. So I didn't have more than that. So I just put that 800,000 rupees into it. And I thought that let's see where it goes. And at that point in time, I remember I was doing this 1,000 rupees SIP. Because for all the knowledge and all the things I was getting into, I still felt that, okay, I need to safeguard my education cost maybe. So I put that 1,000 rupee per month into a mutual fund. I put that on basically an SIP that you're aware of. So that 24,000 rupees I remember at which I put into that mutual fund, literally paid for my education that time for those 2 years or something like that. And on the parallel, I was trying to create this iteration process. So it takes a long time, but if you are, so the example which I gave you from that person, maybe if things go right, you achieve it in 5 years, 6 years, 7 years. So it's not that you're only doing this, right? You will keep doing what you are doing.
Right.
It's like maybe you're cutting your leisure hours and putting some part of investment hour attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
And slowly it might interest you.
How do you think about valuations like while approaching this? Is it through like, does the report itself like give you like some idea as to like mismatch in valuations?
No, so I think as I told you in the beginning that valuation is just a creation, it's a derived thing. It's not the thing which leads you to make investments, right?
Mm-hmm.
Valuations of the same 100 rupees earned by different companies is different. And sometimes valuation is basis perception. So you have to read through whether, for example, a retail company can be valued at 100 times, but a similar retail company started by someone else is valued at 10 times. So why this mismatch? So the valuation always factors about the business perception, the promoter perception, and in early stage companies, valuation is not even a metric, right? It's a derived value. And although you keep reading those reports that this company was valued so high, look at the public companies. But the point is the path was of disruption, and day one you have to factor in that how much money do you put, what does the founder want, can you put a number to it? Yes, you can put a derived number to it, but is that the right way to put in money in some company, maybe not. So maybe you would want that podcast come because you are so passionate about, say, podcast, you would be valuing it at 50 crore and still be happy with it. But someone like me, I would say, okay, this is worth only 10 crore. So it's a lot about the ability of the business to scale up and those kind of finer details versus only giving a number to, say, price to earnings or price to sales. They are good when you're doing large company investments because they are matured, as you said, they're growing at a decent pace, and you have to choose between, say, buying an Infosys or a TCS or, say, a Wipro or a Tech Mahindra. So that time you will say, okay, let's see the valuations, let's put numbers around, let's see who's making what cash, and then I'll decide which company to choose. Yes, it makes sense. But for smaller companies, only valuation will not play, will fit the math. The various things which are happening in parallel. So you need to combine all those things and then decide, okay, what is it? You'll have to figure out that if I put X rupees at 50 crore, suppose in the best case scenario, this podcast company makes 10 crore, what would be it worth after 5 years? And you get an answer that, okay, that 10 crore, no one will buy it more than 50 crore again. So why am I putting it at 50? I should put it in at 10. Mm-hmm. So that when it actually reaches its destination, you make money. And that's where the mismatch in a lot of companies dying down is, right? Because some people estimated it to grow very fast, but they did not. And what happened is that there's a double whammy. Because it did not grow, there are no numbers, and the perception changed. So if you were valued at, say, $5 billion, and you as an investor, Ryan, put in this company at, say, $1 billion valuation, you thought, okay, wow, everything checks, this will be worth $5 billion. But after 5 years, it did not achieve its numbers, and on the other side, the perception became detrimental. So now that it did not reach 5 billion, it reached 200 million.
Uh-huh.
So these are the complexities attached with valuation. And it's, although we can discuss it in a generic way, but it's so much dependent on the promoter, the sector, the stage of investing. So at seed or pre-seed or that stage, how do you define valuation? It's obviously, I've seen people raising money at, say, $20 billion base valuation. But point is that the moment people see you are not going on the right track, this valuation will collapse.
Mm-hmm.
So it will be worth nothing. Because at the first place, there was no number through which this valuation number came in. There was no metric primarily. Although slowly and steadily, you can have sales matrix and revenue matrix or profitability or EBITDA or app download matrix, daily user matrix. But eventually, when all these things start not performing well, all your valuation judgments go wrong. So that's what it is. As long as the company stops growing in the way you want it to be,
mm-hmm.
then the valuation will not play a role.